Hi, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. How are you? Well, last week, I said that I was going to tell you how I was later in the program, and I never did, so I'm going to tell you now, because when Gary and I did our show last week, and it was a really fun show, and I hope you liked it. We got some great feedback about it. We were both heading into really bad colds, and that's how I was. That's how we were, and it's hard. It's hard when you have a cold and you feel like doing nothing, and there's so much looming around you that you want to do, but then all of a sudden, you don't want to do anything. And I actually spent Christmas Eve doing exactly that. I was a zombie, horizontal most of the time, couldn't do anything. And I'm on the mend, and I'm grateful for being on the mend. You know, there's nothing like when you bang your head against the wall, how good it feels when you stop, right? Not that I'm recommending banging your head against the wall, but a simple thing like a cold, you really appreciate not having one. And it's the little things. I always like to talk about breathing and how good breathing can be. It's the most important thing that we do, because when we stop breathing, the game's over. We can stop drinking water a little while, and we've got a few days where we could do that, and we can stop eating and do that for a long time, surprisingly, if you've ever done a water fast or read about them. Some people can go a good 40 days, 2 months, or more, depending on how much fat or non-essential stores they have on their bodies. But breathing air, we can't live without. And when you have a cold, it's so hard to breathe. And then when it lets up and it goes away, breathing is so good. So once again, I'm appreciating breathing. And, you know, I always like to talk about food. And there's that expression, starve a fever, feed a cold. Feed a fever, starve a cold. Basically, if you don't feel like eating, that's the best thing to do, not eat. When you don't feel like eating, when you're hungry, eat. So I don't think there's anything to that. If one way's right or the other, starve a cold, starve a fever, feed a cold, feed a fever. Basically, it's best to listen to yourself. And there was a period during last week where, I couldn't eat anything. And that was became particularly challenging around Christmas Eve, which really was the height of my cold. And that's when people started cooking. And people don't do a lot of cooking, but they do some on the holidays. And I don't normally notice what people cook in my apartment building because they don't do a lot of cooking. And we do a lot of cooking. And our food fragrances overwhelm anything else that might be wafting in. But we weren't cooking, and I could smell a lot of unpleasant smells. When you don't eat animals, you may have noticed this, and you start to smell flesh being cooked. It can be very offensive, and when you're sick, it's even more offensive. And I was getting a lot of that, which added to the fun. But there were some nice things about it. One is I really like to make a ginger lemon tea. And I ask myself why I don't make it more often, because it really is delicious and comforting. And I will put a recipe up for it very soon at responsibleeatingandliving.com, where I live. But basically, it's just fresh ginger, grated ginger, some lemon zest and lemon juice. And if you have a tea egg or a tea basket for your teapot, you put that in there. And if you don't, you can just put it at the bottom of a pot and add boiling water to it. And if you like, you can sweeten it with a little agave. And it's just so comforting. And it's good for you, too. And that's the kind of thing that I like to drink and sip on when I'm not feeling quite right. Another thing that I like to do is use eucalyptus, the essential oil eucalyptus. When I was growing up, very often when I wasn't feeling well, My parents would use Vicks Vapor Rub, which was like a petroleum jelly base with eucalyptus. And I like to make a much simpler version of that with vegetable glycerin and a few drops of the eucalyptus essential oil in it. You have to be careful because the essential oil can burn, and when you use it at full strength, it burns. So it has to be diluted either in a glycerin or an oil. And sometimes I just put a few drops in the bathtub, and it's like a giant vaporizer. And that helps. And it's kind of fun when you're not feeling good to use these simple things to help you feel better. There's something cozy about it. Another thing I like to do when ill is binge. And I don't mean binging on food, but I got an opportunity to binge on some films about food. And I thought I'd mention a few of them. There was three in particular. Maybe you've seen some of them. The first one is Chef, and that's about the guy who is a great chef, but ultimately he starts a food truck. And the food in this film is not particularly food that I would promote, but very fun to see someone's passion about food, preparing food, and all the love and attention that goes into it. And I love films like that. I think we all, I don't want to say all of us, but many of us love watching food preparation, especially when there's passion in it. And then another great film was a French film. In French, it's called Comme le Chef, and in English, I think it's just called Le Chef or The Chef, about a Michelin star chef who is being threatened by the owner of his restaurant to make things with less quality ingredients so that they can make more money, a very popular theme, and unfortunately a theme that affects all of our food system, making things faster, better, less quality, cheaper, and that's not good for us. I like stories that promote quality food, even if it's not the kind of food that I eat. Okay, this guy was a classic French chef, and he made a lot of things that were animal-based, but he did have a passion for what he considered quality ingredients, and the young man that helped him support his dream and support his restaurant. It was really lovely, lovely story. And then the other movie was Haute Cuisine, which in French means high cuisine, and it was about based on a true story, although the movie was fictional, about a woman who prepared meals in the private kitchen of François Mitterrand's home when he was president of France. And he had desired food like home-style cooking, like he was used to, that his mother and grandmother used to make. And so he had his staff hired this woman who was known for her home-style cooking. And it was just, again, another great story to see how stories and culture and memories all link together with what we enjoy in food and how quality food is, I think, so important. It makes the experience so lovely. So I binged on movies about food. I wasn't eating food, but I was watching people prepare food. And that's funny because it reminds me, I talked earlier about fasting, and about 15 years ago, I did a 3-week water-only fast. And if you're ever interested in knowing more about that, you can email me at info@realmeals.org. I'd be happy to share that experience with you. I did it primarily out of curiosity to see what it was like. It was something that my favorite doctor, Dr. Furman, recommends to do every 5-10 years, which means I'm due to do one because I haven't done it in over 15. But what I did mostly while fasting, and you're not supposed to do a lot because you slow down and everything moves fast around you. But I did a lot of walking and shopping in this one particular store that sold housewares, and I bought bowls and teapots and things related to food while I wasn't eating. For me, it's all about food. But we're coming back, and that's good news. And today, we created some new recipes, because that's what we like to do for you. And we put up two new recipes today. One is a red cabbage pineapple slaw, which we like to call, how did this Costa Rican pineapple get into my New York slaw? And it's made with red cabbage, and I've been learning a lot more about red cabbage, especially after talking to Dr. Michael Greger a few weeks ago on this program with his new book that came out, How Not to Die. But red cabbage, some people call it purple cabbage, is a powerhouse packed with great nutrition. And we have this great red cabbage pineapple slaw. We picked up a pineapple yesterday. Ooh, say that fast. Picked up a pineapple. Gary created it and diced it in with the red cabbage, and the combination is just spectacular. And we have leftovers, and I'm salivating right now thinking about it and knowing that I'm going to have some later after this show is over. We also made a wonderful soup. It tastes like an enchilada, although it's a soup. And you can get both of those recipes right now at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Later in the program, we have a great guest coming on. We have Dr. Michelle McMakin, and whenever she comes into the studio, we will bring her on. I'm expecting her at least by 4:30, but if she gets in earlier, I'm going to take advantage of that. I'm really excited to speak with her. She is an absolute delight and doing wonderful, wonderful things, and I hope this is the face, the new face of physicians coming out of medical school and getting introduced to our medical community today. This is the doctor of the future, at least in my image of what the future should be. So stay tuned for that. In the meanwhile, I'm going to continue talking about some things I've been thinking about. I'm sure you have. There are many people today, people in the how-to or self-help community. Many are related to food. Some are related to methods to feeling good. And they offer free webinars. I know I've been involved in a few. And some of them are really excellent. But you've probably noticed a pattern where after the webinar, something is sold. And sometimes it can be offensive. Sometimes it can be very interesting. And you want, after this great webinar of information, you want to get more and you want to buy the product. It's something that I guess we need to do in the marketing world today, especially online, taking advantage of the online community and the power of the internet and free advertising. But it's hard to know how not to be taken by some of these marketing ploys. I know I spend all of my time, my free time and my not free time, learning about food, reading about food, and when I see someone's product or listen to some people's offerings, videos, whatever it may be, I can tell whether the information is good or not good based on all the science that I've read. I know it's not as easy for many people, and that's a challenge with some of these marketing methods, because they can be really slick, they can be really convincing, and then you end up making the person promoting it rich, and the product is not very good. I was reviewing some products recently, and I was surprised at some of the things I discovered by some of them, because some of these people can sound knowledgeable, and then they end up saying some stuff that really is not supported by current science, not supported by the current knowledge that we have, and people can really be led astray. I'm not going to mention any names. what I do want to say is I hope that you trust the information that I have or the information that we present at my nonprofit, Responsible Eating and Living, and we're not selling you anything. Everything on our website is free, and that makes me feel more confident about what we're offering. if you ever do have a question about health, a question about something someone has said that you're not quite sure about, you can always send me an email at info@realmeals.org, and I will be happy, do my best, to find out whether it's valuable, credible, or not. Okay, I've got some other things I want to talk about, but guess what? My guest has arrived, and I want to take advantage of that. So let me introduce you to Dr. Michelle McMakin. She is a board-certified internal medicine physician and assistant professor of medicine at NYU School of Medicine, an honors graduate of Yale University and Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. She has more than 10 years' experience practicing primary care, directing a medical weight loss program, and teaching doctors in training at Bellevue Hospital Center in New York City. Dr. McMakin is an enthusiastic supporter of plant-based nutrition and is committed to educating patients and doctors about the power of healthy eating and lifestyle modification. And she has a certificate in plant-based nutrition from Cornell University. I do too. Thank you for joining me on It's All About Food.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Well, I met you at, if you remember, at the Veg News Comfort Food Shindig, which was a fabulous Manhattan event.
Sure was.
And what I loved about meeting you was you have an infectious smile. Maybe infectious isn't the right word.
That does have a negative connotation, but at least it's a smile.
It just came out of me. I realized what I was saying.
I know what you mean.
It makes other people want to smile back. That's what infectious means in this particular case. And your energy just was bouncing off the walls. And I was so excited and thrilled to hear that you are a medical doctor here in New York doing wonderful things. Thank you so much for that.
Oh, thank you.
Now, how can we clone you?
There's actually, you know, as far as physicians who are interested in how food and lifestyle habits can actually promote healing, true healing and getting to the root cause of disease, there's a really growing movement in this area, and something I've been really lucky to be a part of, particularly through the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. And as far as plant-based nutrition and veganism, there's also a growing movement, I believe. Maybe it's just I've reached out to a lot of vegan doctors, but
it is growing in New York.
Yeah.
Maybe not as much in Mississippi, but definitely in New York.
Right. Well, I think it is. I think things are getting off the ground, and hopefully we'll just keep expanding.
I don't know why this flashed into my mind, but when I was 15 years old, that's when I first got the idea not to eat animals. I was in school. There was a friend of mine named David, and he announced he was vegetarian. And I think I told this story last week on the show, but I saw him 20 years later and said he was like the reason for my life's path. And he said that he had only been vegetarian for a week. But the real part of that story is my mom was concerned about what I should eat. And at that time, I was still eating dairy. So she just kept saying, eat more cottage cheese, which we've learned later wasn't the best thing. But, you know, she cared. And she brought me to our physician. And he was always slim and tan and very, I'll just stop at that. But my mom asked him if it was okay if I didn't eat meat, and his response was, you should eat meat because that gives the opportunity for more cows to live. And that was his,
that was
his knowledgeable advice to me. And I'm happy to say I didn't listen to him.
You trusted your instincts. You had good instincts.
But, you know, just an interesting perspective and so clueless.
Yeah, I mean, I think it reflects to some degree the fact that, you know, in terms of medical training, I mean, what people have heard is actually true, that, you know, doctors get something like fewer than 20 hours in their entire 4 years of medical school education, and very little, you know, is folded into their residency or their postgraduate training. And so, unfortunately, I think doctors are, on the one hand, you know, not that much more knowledgeable about healthy eating than the average person, and they're subject to the same misunderstandings and you know, media pressure, marketing pressure as everybody else. And on the other hand, they're actually expected to be an authority. So patients come to them and then they'll ask a question like your mom did of your doctor. And then, you know, sort of what the doctor says goes. And there's not, unfortunately, a lot of basis for a lot of those recommendations.
You know, I started out my adult career in as an engineer. I had a master's in chemical engineering. I was in the semiconductor industry. And one of the first things that I learned that was really important, at least to get the confidence of my clients and colleagues, was that if someone asked me a question and I didn't know the answer, I said, I don't know.
Humility is a very good quality.
But I'm going to do my best to find out for you. And whenever a doctor gives me an answer that I know is wrong, I think of that. Why can't you say, I don't know?
Well, it seems so, you know, first of all, I agree with you, of course, but it also just seems so, I think even doctors realize that they should know the answer to that. And to say, I don't know, to every single question about food would be, you know, frankly, really almost an embarrassment about their training. And it's not, it's a broad problem. It's not any individual's issue. It's a broad issue.
Okay, so you're doing this wonderful thing. You received a grant to study and teach plant-based nutrition to other doctors. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so this is something I'm really excited about. Basically, you know, just to give you a little context, I myself have been vegetarian for decades, since I was 13, and then eventually became vegan about 8 years ago now. And really, unfortunately, it didn't really, my own choices didn't really spread into the way I practiced medicine at first. And I kind of kept it to myself and kind of worked through, you know, changes in how to modify my own lifestyle as far as becoming vegan, and really was very extremely grateful that I had made that decision. It was really the right decision, but didn't really incorporate it into my practice until a couple of years ago when I went to this American College of Lifestyle Medicine meeting, and I saw that there's a huge community of physicians out there that not only really care about using healthy eating and exercise and stress reduction to help get to the root cause of disease, but to there's a segment of those that are also very interested in plant-based nutrition. And so I can't even tell you how empowering it was to see all these other people that were that sort of thought like me and ate like me. And, you know, and I just felt so empowered to kind of come back to my job and start putting this into practice. And it's, you know, because I work in an academic center and I'm responsible for teaching medical students and doctors in training, I thought, you know, this is the perfect opportunity to take, you know, what I've learned. And, you know, just 3 years ago, I would have, I didn't know much more than anybody else about nutrition. I made a choice for being vegan about, because I just couldn't, I kind of, you know, putting foods on my plate that required, you know, so much cruelty and so much harm just was not in line with my values. But as far as the actual nutritional benefits, I really didn't know that much. And so as I learned more and as I did my own research, I thought this is wonderful. I can actually start educating other people because the science is profound. And if you start dipping your toe into the pool of that science, you can't believe how much there is. And it's just, I think, you know, people like to think nutrition is so complicated, but it's really not. Most of the roads lead to the same place. And there's, yes, some little controversies at the extreme. But the themes are broad and the consensus is broad. So around that time that I came back from that conference and got really excited, I applied for a grant to so that I could sort of legitimize my study of nutrition and evidence-based nutrition and then develop a curriculum that I could teach to my, starting actually with my faculty colleagues, because my colleagues who are also physicians and at the same level of training as me are also responsible for teaching. So I thought, well, let's start with the people that do the teaching and then we can kind of, you know, evolve this into to teaching others. And so we're about to roll out our, I got the grant together with another colleague of mine and a fellow vegan physician, and and we're going to be rolling out the curriculum this spring.
Wow. So is this a curriculum for physicians that are already physicians?
Yes. So the first phase will be we're teaching, you know, our colleagues who are also supervisors like us. And so people who have gone through all of their formal training and are now in the role of teaching other people. And I also give lectures to doctors in training, and I, you know, coach them one-on-one when they see patients, and sort of at every opportunity trying to get the message out there about healthy eating.
Was there any pushback against this program doing something like this?
No, quite the contrary. I have found that every time I've given a lecture or talked about nutrition in the context of a particular patient, people have, you know, other doctors have just been so excited to learn and actually quite humble about their lack of knowledge around it. And I think if you present things in a way that keep it very simple and very practical, because we don't have a lot of time and we don't have a lot of resources, and, you know, just things that people can actually do, and also keep it light, keep it so that, you know, there's this sense, I think, that when you teach people about a new drug, you know, they're able to maintain, as a doctor, they're able to maintain a distance between themselves and the patient because, you know, they're not going to be the ones taking that drug, at least, you know, not right now. Whereas with food, everyone eats. So it necessarily sort of hits home. And I think it conjures up a lot of feelings around everyone's personal decisions. So I think keeping it, acknowledging that discomfort, but keeping it light and keeping it humorous and just providing evidence-based information is really useful.
Okay, so in Dr. McMakin's world of planning a future educational path for doctors, would you include this nutritional training after doctors became licensed to practice or before?
Oh, no. I mean, I think this has to start from day one in medical school. I think, you know, we're looking at a situation where we have to change the entire paradigm of medicine. It's not just teaching nutrition. It's leaving space for people to understand that when we use pills and procedures and surgeries, a lot of the time we're not getting to the root of the problem. We're treating symptoms. And for some people, that might be what they want. But there are plenty of people that are open to learning how they can actually be empowered to change their lifestyle and just need to have instruction and support on how to do that. And at a minimum, have, you know, sort of backup by their doctor, even if their doctor can't explain exactly how to do it, have their doctor say, yes, I think that's a great idea, go for it. So I think we have to change the entire paradigm, and I think that has to happen in a multifaceted way, and it does have to start from day one of medical school. So it's not just the nutrition training.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is it's not just facts. It's not just teaching people, you know, animal protein is directly linked with causing diabetes. You know, every time I tell that to another doctor, they're surprised.
Mm.
Patients haven't heard it. Doctors haven't heard it. And it's been out there in the literature for a very long time. And it's, you know, a lot of studies support that. So that's a fact. But then how do you sit down in front of a patient and actually translate that into a behavior change? That's another skill. And so we're going to have to address this on multiple levels.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're starting and putting it out there to the universe,
yeah,
and that's good. There's just so much that a doctor has to learn in medical school. So how do you add more to that?
Yes. Yeah,
but that's not your problem.
Well, it is and it isn't, but you're absolutely right. There is. It's like, how do you fit in yet another body of knowledge? But, I mean, we're facing a situation where, you know, I think something like 75% of our healthcare costs are because of chronic disease, which is most of which is foodborne, heart disease, diabetes, obesity, many cancers, stroke, Alzheimer's. You know, the list goes on and on.
In my world, when people finally get the power of good nutrition and we're all eating more plants and less animals, if any animals at all, and all of a sudden all these chronic diseases go down to a low murmur, then what our medical practitioners can work on is all those mysterious things.
That's right.
I mean, not just the
like
broken
house
arms
episodes
and legs, but all the mysterious things. And we can get really good at solving those problems, which are now so masked. because you don't know, is this a chronic food-related illness or something mysterious or a combination? It's a mess.
Right.
So let's get rid of all of the type 2 diabetes, which we don't even call type 2 anymore. Or, no, we call it type 2, what we used to call adult onset diabetes, because now children have it. And, you know, heart disease, gone. You know, my cousin, I saw her recently, and she said she was diagnosed with cardiovascular disease. And her doctor told her, you know, take these drugs, and you can't reverse it, but at least you could slow it down. And I looked at her, are you kidding me? What sands has his head been in, and for how long?
Yeah, it is really shocking, as I said before, when you start to read what's out there, and frankly, things that have been out there. I mean, Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn's book on reversing heart disease. I mean, that information has been out there for a decade.
Well, especially when Bill Clinton got the message, that was on major news. I thought everybody heard it.
Yeah.
Okay. Phew. All right.
slowly but surely.
Yes, well, I'm very excited to hear that more doctors are learning and want to learn about plant-based food. I have so many doctor stories where they could have used this a long time ago. And some of the responses I remember getting from some doctors was really not believing that patients wanted to hear this information, that they wanted things quick and easy. And I believe, not that we're all sheep, although many of us are. if we hear the right information often enough from our doctors and everyone else, we're going to get it and want it. And by the way, it's delicious. You're not deprived. You're not suffering. You get the side effects are all good. You look younger. You feel better.
That's right. I just sometimes want to, you know, sing at the top of the mountains, like, it's all good. You know?
It's all good.
It's all good. But I haven't had that experience at all when it comes. That is a common misconception that patients don't want to hear it. But that has not been my experience whatsoever. Maybe a handful of people who said, you know, I really don't feel like changing right now. And they've sometimes under extraordinarily difficult social circumstances, but the majority of people want to hear how they can help their body heal. You know, they live with terrible chronic pain, arthritis, inflammation, high blood pressure, tons of pills. They want to hear how they can heal. And then the challenge is helping them do that.
How's the food at Bellevue Hospital?
You know, I pack a lunch most days, and I would anyway. You know, it gives me more control and lets me eat exactly what I want to eat. But hospital food in general, you know, is a huge issue in every hospital that I know of.
I had my own big hospital experience in 2006, 2007. I had advanced ovarian cancer, and I experienced some local hospitals, Brooklyn Hospital, Richmond Hospital, and Staten Island. They were disasters. And then I ended up happily at Mount Sinai, and they had much better food. But still, I had problems with them, and that was 9 years ago. recently, another cousin, unfortunately, has ovarian cancer, and I've spent some time with her when she was visiting, when she was at Sloan Kettering. And people may know Sloan Kettering is not my favorite hospital, so I'm sure some people love it, but I have not had good experiences there. Even 9 years after my own experience with my cousin, I didn't really particularly care for what was going on. But the cafeteria was pretty awesome.
Wow.
Tofu, beans, salad bar. I could eat happily there and did. And their menu even had some pretty nice vegan options where they used the word vegan.
That was 9 years ago?
No, this was this year.
Oh, I was going to Well, I mean, it's progressive now,
No, now.
That's wonderful.
So that was very encouraging.
That is very heartening.
Very encouraging.
I mean, everyone's going to have to get on board. I rode Amtrak yesterday. And I saw they have now two vegan options on the Northeast Corridor. I hope they keep them. But I immediately wrote to them and said, thank you. I mean, consumer demand is what's going to drive
this
thing.
Yes. And we want it. Get it. We want it.
There's a lot of us.
I'm going to give my sister credit for the meals on Amtrak. I'm sure she's not the one, but she traveled on Amtrak a few years ago, and the food was horrible, and she let them know.
Yeah.
And we have to let food suppliers know what we want.
That's right.
That's all. They have to know. Don't be shy. Speak up. Okay. I am getting so hungry. which is really good, because I was just talking earlier about I've had this bad cold, and on Christmas Eve, I had no appetite, and it was really sad. But it's great to have an appetite and love the food that you're eating. All right, speaking of loving eating, let's talk about your weight loss program.
Who doesn't love to eat?
I do.
I know I do, too.
I love eating, and I love eating whatever I want, whenever I want, as much as I want and I can.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty, it's phenomenal, and it's a pretty, it's been a pretty well-kept secret, but I think the secret's getting out that, you know, when you're eating mostly unprocessed, whole food, plant-based diet, you really, you never have to get out a Fitbit counting your calories or measure portions.
Portions are big.
Right.
It's big food.
Eat when you're hungry. and it's really great. And plus you feel great while you're doing it and you don't feel deprived. I've been directing a medical weight loss program for 10 years. And the focus of our program has always been lifestyle change. It's not been pills and it's not been surgery. Although we work side by side with a bariatric surgery or weight loss surgery program. And I have to say the first, 7 years of directing the program, we all followed a very traditional model of helping people reduce portions and, you know, exactly. And
I was rolling my eyes.
She was rolling her eyes. and so around the same time that I had this sort of epiphany around using lifestyle as medicine, I said, well, you know, I'm rolling this out to every aspect of my life and every aspect of my professional practice. And so I've been exclusively counseling on transitioning people to plant-based diets and the weight loss program. And I have to say that both in my daily regular internal medicine practice and in the weight loss program, people just lose weight without really trying. And, you know, I think there is, for some people, there is a fear, you know, I think for some people, there is a barrier that they don't want to go on a plant-based or vegan diet because they're worried about losing weight. And that's a separate issue, which I can address.
Mm-hmm.
But for the vast majority of people that I take care of, there is an interest in losing weight for their health and for other reasons. So it's a welcome surprise to see that, you know, they come back to see me, you know, a month or 3 months later, and just almost like accidentally, they've lost 10 pounds. And they feel more energetic. They're sleeping better. They're no longer constipated.
Mm.
Their blood pressure is better. Their pre-diabetes is gone away. You know, it's just, you name it, and it's better. So it's just extremely rewarding.
Yes. Okay. Is there a structure to this obesity plan, like the first things you tell your clients to eat or not eat?
Well, I spend a little time going over the broad principles of, you know, what's an animal-based food, what's a plant-based food, what do I really mean by those things, and dispelling the notion that it's a diet that they're going to follow temporarily, that this is more of a lifestyle change, and it's something that has been shown to be sustainable and should be sustainable for them in order to reap the benefits long-term. And that, you know, there's a number of diet, quote unquote, diets out there that I could prescribe for them where they would lose weight in the short term, but it wouldn't do them any favors in the long run. They would gain the weight back. They would increase their risk of heart disease and other complications. So we are targeting long-term health with a nice side effect of weight loss. So I go over those basic principles, and I also go over the principle that it's not about adding any one particular little magic food to your unhealthy diet. You know, if you continue eating what you're eating and you eat some goji berries.
You were reading my mind. That was exactly the food I was going to say.
It's always the goji berries. No, I mean, so it's not about addition of any one particular food. It's about the broad eating pattern. What is your overall pattern of eating? So after those after I sort of go through that basic information, I actually then turn it over to the patient because I always want to start from where they're starting from. So I take a detailed history around what the foods are that they like, and we hone in on the plant-based foods that they already like. And of course, I'm looking at this through a nexus of socioeconomic challenges, culture, language, and I mean, I treat a very diverse patient population, so half the time I'm on Google Images trying to figure out what food somebody's talking about, but we start from there. Figure out what are the plant-based foods that are minimally processed that we can start with, and just start expanding those on the plate and crowding out some of the other foods, and getting people to understand that they shouldn't be filling up on foods that don't promote health. And take it sort of one day at a time. I know there's a whole philosophy out there, and there's a number of programs where people kind of go all out, and that's amazing if you can do it. Mm-hmm. But you need a lot of support, and you need a lot of, you know, sometimes almost like an immersion situation, or someone who's just really, really motivated and really ready. For the majority of people that I take care of, it's more about a gradual progression and starting to really move towards a plant-based diet over the course of weeks or months.
I coach people on moving to a plant-based diet, and I've seen that as well. In fact, I was just thinking of this recently. When I first started, what I really wanted to do was some sort of like Vulcan mind meld and just give them all the information I possibly could. And I'm talking about, you know, my life. All I've spent decades absorbing this information, and you just want to give it to them right away, but people can't. Most people can't take it all in all at once.
That's
you have
right.
to go really gently. And there's a lot of reasons for that, not just because it's a lot of stuff, but they have their lives, they have their jobs, they have their families, they have their kids, they have all
right.
kinds of activities. There's just so much going on. So slow and steady, I think, works best for people. Is there like a time frame? Do you find how long it takes most people to get it?
There is no average time frame. I mean, some people are just, you know, I saw a patient in July who she was just ready, and she had already done her research and said, this is, I want to go on a plant-based diet, which is, you know, my dream, you
mm-hmm.
know, have a patient like that. Great. And we went through some resources and some strategies. And then the next time I saw her, she had done it and, you know,
wow.
already had lost a lot of weight. And then there's people who don't, they come to me wanting a diet. They have a lot of, they're on a totally different page. They want pills or a diet. And so then we, you know, there's some activation energy just around getting over those philosophical differences.
So this weight loss program, do people still have to see you like they're going to a doctor's visit for this program?
They see me like they're going to a doctor's visit.
Right. So how often can many of them see you?
I mean, we are set up so that people can see us every 2 to 4 weeks and, you know, less frequently as they lose weight and maintain to try to, you know, keep the weight off. But at the very beginning, you do need to be seen more intensely. And so that's kind of how we're structured. And I think in the ideal, you know, the ideal model would be a combination of groups and individual visits. And groups work really well for
mm-hmm.
some people. We don't have that as part of our program right now, but we have in the past and are hoping to have that again in the future.
Okay. I'm just breathing. Breathing is really good. I was talking about breathing before. We just take breathing for granted so often. And I just like breathing.
Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned prediabetes before. And I know some people that have gotten this prediabetes diagnosis, and they think they're okay. And my understanding is, you know, prediabetes really is too soft a term for what it is. How do you feel about prediabetes?
I mean, you know, the last time I reviewed the literature on this, I think what I saw was that about, on average, about 40 to 50% of people with prediabetes go on to develop full-on type 2 diabetes. However, you're right, it's not just, you know, a number on your blood test results where you're fine, and then one day you cross over to the line and you're not fine. You have type 2 diabetes. It really is a continuum of metabolic disease. And so we're seeing in people that have prediabetes some of the same consequences that people with type 2, full-on type 2 diabetes have. So, for example, some of the nerve inflammation and nerve damage that people have, what's called peripheral neuropathy or diabetic neuropathy, we're seeing in people with pre-diabetes. So it's not a quiescent state, but it is a wonderful opportunity to change things around because it's one of the disease conditions that's most responsive to changing one's diet and lifestyle. And the trick is just getting the right advice on what to do.
Right. So if you have a pre-diabetes diagnosis, I have Dr. McMakin here. What would you recommend, doctor?
So I'm going to answer that question by telling you what's going on at the level of your organs. So in the progression from pre-diabetes to type 2 diabetes, what's happening is that your body is producing insulin, and we all produce insulin to help sugar in our blood go into our cells. As people become go from pre-diabetes to diabetes, their body gets less and less responsive to the insulin. They're sort of resistant to that insulin. Mm-hmm. It's like the insulin won't unlock the key, to let the sugar into the cells. And so when that happens, if you eat something that has a lot of sugar in it, the sugar will then go into your bloodstream and will build up in your bloodstream and won't go into your cells. So people always think that the problem is carbohydrates. But really, when you look at carbohydrates, those are just more of a symptom of the problem. So if you reduce your carbohydrates, sure, your blood sugar will go down, but it's not really getting to the root of the problem. What's the root of the problem? That is the fact that our bodies become resistant to the insulin because of the fat in our muscle cells, which is directly related to animal protein and animal fats, and also because some of the iron that's in animal forms, what we call heme iron, is directly toxic to our pancreas, the cells that make insulin. And there's a number of other reasons as well, but a lot of it leads back to animal protein. Study after study has shown that especially red meat and processed meat, which are foods like bacon, sausage, pepperoni, deli meats, hot dogs, things that people in our country eat sometimes twice a day, three times a day. These are the foods that are most likely to cause diabetes. It's not the sugar in your coffee. It's not the pastry. I'm not saying those things are good for you, but those are not the foods that are going to cause diabetes. In fact, when you look at what foods are most likely to protect you from diabetes, it's carbohydrates. It's whole grains. So eating whole grain foods in their most natural form, so brown rice, oats, barley, foods like that.
Really screwed this up over the last few decades, haven't we?
Right. And so if you have pre-diabetes, focus on whole plant foods. Get your plant foods in their most unprocessed form. So simple foods that most of us are used to eating, like old-fashioned oatmeal made with, not with dairy milk, but with either almond milk or water. Focusing on a lot of leafy green vegetables. Beans are an amazing food for both people with already have diabetes and pre-diabetes. They help lower your blood sugar. They have a lot of really healthy fiber. And leave animal products off your plate.
And I just want to take a brief break here and talk about Responsible Eating and Living, which is my nonprofit, because I have a daily blog called What Vegans Eat. And when Dr. McMakin was talking about oats, you can see almost every morning, I have oats in one form or another. And if you don't believe, that oats can be interesting or delicious, you can try any one of these. Many of them are linked to recipes. Some of them I just kind of discuss how I prepare it. But it's either cooked or not cooked. It's got loads of raw nuts and seeds and fresh fruit, maybe some dried fruit, shredded coconut, your favorite non-dairy milk, preferably unsweetened. And that's it. And it's delicious.
Now you're making me hungry. I love oats, too. I eat oatmeal almost every morning.
But, it could be a brown rice cereal left over from your brown rice the night before.
Quinoa
or a millet.
Porridge.
Quinoa, millet, buckwheat. I'm a big fan of buckwheat. And, it doesn't have to be grains either. You can have a salad for breakfast. Mm-hmm. That's perfectly fine. But carbs, there are good carbs and there are bad carbs. And you want to get the good carbs, right?
Here's to that.
Okay, so that's all about pre-diabetes. I think we need to change the name or something because It's not a safe diagnosis. You're not in the safety zone. This is like yellow light, maybe even with some flashing red.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we just have, let's see, maybe 6 minutes left or so. I want to know, what does Dr. McMakin eat? What do you bring to lunch?
I have a lot of variety, but breakfast is typically oatmeal. Typically have oats with...
And that's not... I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that's not the little prepackaged oats in a bag that you add hot water to. So gross.
No, I don't eat those. I have usually an old-fashioned, like a steel cut or just regular, rolled oats. But the old-fashioned kind. I'm a big fan of cinnamon. Mm. I'm a big fan of walnuts. Add raisins, pecans, sometimes fresh fruit. Just mix it up, just like you.
Yeah.
we're breakfast twins.
Today, I just have to say, you mentioned cinnamon, and I'm lucky because I love to cook, and my partner Gary loves to cook, and we take turns, or we do it together, and when one doesn't feel like, usually the other does, vice versa, whatever. And he made the oatmeal this morning, and he's really into cinnamon sticks these days. And he was saying that the cinnamon stick, he likes it so much better than the powder, and it just gives a great flavor, and then it's kind of fun to suck on the cinnamon stick afterwards.
I'll have to try that.
It's really good.
The other thing I love to make is our overnight oats. I don't know if you
to make those.
Yes,
soaked oats.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
So good. So I make them with some chia and a mashed up banana and some unsweetened almond milk and, of course, the oats and some cinnamon. And then I sprinkle some, like, walnuts or hemp seeds and fruit on the top. When I talk to patients about breakfast options, I always tell them I think there's this unfortunate perception that being vegan / plant-based involves all these weird foods that you've never heard of. And so that's why I kind of try to start with where the patient's at to sort of demystify what this means. And so sometimes I hesitate to say, use hemp seeds and chia seeds. But as people grow into the process, they realize these foods are not that crazy and unusual. They taste great. They're great for you. So that's a typical breakfast. Lunch is usually a big salad, but I find that if I just have leafy greens, I'll be hungry within an hour. So I add a lot of bulk to it. I'll usually add like some kind of a cruciferous vegetable and broccoli. I'll add certainly at least like two kinds of beans. Sometimes I'll even add tofu. I will put in a little bit of avocado and lemon as my dressing. Sometimes orange slices, just kind of really mix everything up. It's usually on like a spinach base or kale base, something like that. And then in the afternoon, I will have a fruit, sometimes some nut butter, a little bit of nut butter with
That's always good.
Dinner will be, I'm really into soups, like big, hearty mm-hmm. stews.
Big soups. Dr. Furman would be proud of you.
So channeling that. That's a typical day.
Yeah. And you probably tell your patients this, but soups are probably the easiest thing to make. You start with a big pot. You just you don't have to saute really anything. If you want, you can cook your mirepoix, your onions and carrots and celery, the things that really give flavor. You can saute them or not. Just throw them in and add a lot of water. Add your beans if you want to add a whole grain and get creative. There's just, you can make 400 million trillion different varieties of soups. And
it lasts all week.
Lasts all week.
Yeah.
I made I measured it. It ended up being 12 cups of azuki beans that I had started from dry and
awesome.
Cooked and ended up with 12 cups. And it lasted all week. And we just finished it yesterday in a wonderful soup that Gary made, which we're calling enchilada sauce soup. It tastes like enchiladas, but it's a soup. That's really good.
So what's in it?
What's in it? Well, he made it. And you can find the recipe at responsibleeatingandliving.com. It's on the homepage today.
I'll definitely check that out.
But it's you know, something I didn't realize a long time ago, but the sauces that come with an enchilada, it's a tomato-based sauce, but what makes it different from an Italian sauce is the spices that you put in it. So it's got to have, you know, the chili sauce and have the chili powder, cumin, and the other spices that typically spice up a Mexican dish. And some other recipes that you're, some other ingredients that you're going to have to discover by visiting responsibleeatingandliving.com. I'm not giving it all away right now here. I want some action. Okay, so we have about 3-4 minutes left. And favorite places to eat in Manhattan, the greatest city in the world for vegan food?
And add Brooklyn.
Okay, New York City.
Yes.
5 boroughs, including Queens, where I live, where we now have Green Symphony. And I was kind of sad because we had this place that showed up in the next town over to me. I live in Forest Hills, and in Regal Park, there was a restaurant called Simple Veggie. It arrived a little over 2 years ago, I think. And then they just sold it recently. I was very sad. But they brought in a group that I'm familiar with that had restaurants in a variety of places in New York, and now they're in our neighborhood. It's called Green Zenfony. They don't have a website up yet. I keep slamming them for that because I keep posting in my blog about them. But I love big noodle soups, Asian noodle soups,
oh,
and they make
too.
The best.
Oh, me too.
Come to Green Symphony. Let me know when you're there, and I'll meet you there.
Wait, what part of where
it's
is it?
It's in Regal Park. It's okay. Right off of the R and M lines.
Okay.
And it's right near the biggest Macy's in the country that has the most traffic, apparently.
Oh, interesting.
Right there. But
so you can
aside
shop
from
and
that,
then get your soup and
yeah. So Brooklyn, Manhattan, what are your favorites?
So gosh, well, I have lived in New York for 20 years, so I've really seen things evolve, and there's so many to choose from. So I've always been a huge fan of the Blossom restaurants, of mm-hmm. course, and I also really like Avant Garden, which is one of the newer kids on the block.
We almost went there for the first time on 2 days before Christmas, and we were too sick to go.
Oh, you have to go.
I know.
You have to try
we
again.
Have to go.
It's a must try. For special occasions, I've gone to Dirt Candy quite a bit, and I really love her creativity around vegan options. And of course, this list would not be complete without a mention of Champs and Champs Diner. And as well as Terry Restaurant. I don't know if you've been there.
Yeah, it's fast food.
Yeah.
Terry, yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Some really great stuff there. So, you know, those are some of the first few places that come to mind. But I have to say that I'm sort of a seasoned pro when it comes to finding, you know, vegan options on menus. And there's gems everywhere. You know, there's a Mexican restaurant right down in our neighborhood where, mm-hmm. you know, it's, of course, it's not advertised as being a vegan restaurant, but there's so many vegan options. There's tofu sour cream and, you know, and all these things. If you want them, you can have them.
Wow.
But just good old fashioned beans and cilantro and great corn tortillas and
please,
tacos.
I'm getting so hungry. Yeah.
So there's just so much abundance out there. If I had to share that, if there was one message I'd like to share with people, it's just abundance in every form. It's abundance of compassion. It's abundance of taste, and abundance of connection with the other souls that we share this planet with and the planet itself.
So. Michelle, you've been great this hour, and we're at the end. So I wanted to thank you very much for joining me. And I'm so excited that you are a medical doctor. We need more of you. So thank you for training other doctors with your knowledge.
Thank you. This has been really fun. Thanks for having
Great.
Me.
Great. Well, I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. One more time, join me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Lots of surprises there for you. Always new things. And remember, not only do I want you to tune in love all the time, like here in this hour, but I also want you to have a delicious week. And Happy New Year! See you in 2016!